You have no friends. Nobody likes you.
I'm not listening.
Well, then listen to Sci-Fi Saturday Night.
We will begin a mass invasion. We'll tell your people to surrender now and avoid war.
Don't think you get me so easily!
It is now time for us to put Earth under our rule.
It's your sacred duty to tell us the truth. Confess that you've been guilty of witchcraft.
You expect me to believe that you can overrun the entire world?
We cannot be defeated. We have never been defeated. That is the message.
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
Sci-Fi Saturday Night.
Beginning in 2019, all Area 51 episodes of Sci-Fi Saturday Night have been enhanced with riboflavin and vitamin D to help augment your auditory experience. Tonight, in episode 416, we look forward with great expectation to people talking and wondering, does the Princess Bride ever get old? Inconceivable. On board for tonight's TalkCast, sitting in at the Sci-Fi Saturday Night Gaming Console and Help Desk, our own back alley freeform fencing champion for the past 3 years, and prodigious prestidigitator of protons and electrons, Kriana, who's not listening. And Cyborg University's preeminent reference librarian, whose current contract requires an inch of standing water wherever she goes. She also thinks that light sticks are magic and enjoys waterproof ukuleles. It's Sombrarian.
So, true story.
Okay.
This year, the Princess Bride is 32 years old.
Ugh. How old does it make that kid then? Oh my God. That kid's like really old.
That's
right?
Fred Savage.
Yeah, I couldn't think of his name, but thank you for remembering.
Yeah, Fred Savage is, yeah.
He's like in his like 50s now or something.
He's in his 40s, but yeah.
Oh my God.
His late 40s.
I feel terrible, but I love the movie. And believe it or not, The Princess Bride has something to do with our guests tonight.
You asked if it ever got old, and I'm telling you that while it is a timeless classic,
it is in fact.
It is in fact old.
I'm just a guy who likes old movies, vintage game shows, and new writers. They call me the Dome. And tonight we have a new writer and an old friend come back to join us again. Joining us tonight are the co-writers of the novella, Those Who Go Forth into the Empty Place of Gods. My God, that's the longest title I've ever seen. Please welcome back Curtis Lawson and welcome for the first time to the show, Doug Rinaldi. Gentlemen, welcome to Sci-Fi Saturday Night.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Well, you know, when Curtis shoots me an email and says, Dome, I got something new for you to read, and if you want to talk about it on the show, that would be cool. I believe it took me about 30 seconds to respond and go, yeah, send it.
Great.
And within about the first hour, I just was about ankle deep into the novella and just kind of went, this has a special place in the pantheon of weird for any number of reasons. It is perhaps one of the most whimsical horror stories I have ever read.
Yeah, it was kind of a balancing act, getting the real dark stuff with the humor, but I felt like it juxtaposed very well together.
So which one of you is the game show addict?
Well, Doug came up with that whole game show thing. He wrote the first couple scenes and came to me. He put up a thing on Facebook saying, "Hey, I've got a couple stories. Anybody want to co-write one of them with me?" And he threw me a couple ideas that he had, and this was the one that really stuck with me. But that first game show scene was all Doug.
Okay, so actually, before we even get to this novella, which damn well better be the start of a series of them, because you've set us up for it. when this comes out, guys, grab it on Amazon, read it in a day, and then start sending them messages saying, where's the next one? Where's the next one? because I'm doing it right now. But so you guys got together kind of by chance.
Well, randomly, we ran back into each other on Facebook in about 2016, 2015. As far as I go, anyway, I was not familiar with who Curtis actually was, even though I actually met him before.
Oh, that happens with Curtis a lot, though. No.
Yeah.
In the early 2000s, we were both in the music scene up here in Boston in two separate bands, two separate genres, but our bands played together. I actually did their band's logo at one point. And when I quit the music scene in like 2005, I just let all that stuff float away. I didn't really give it much thought. And then when Curtis popped up on my radar, became friends on Facebook, I'm like, why does his name sound so familiar? And then he said something about being in a band, and then mutual friends started popping up. I'm like, why does this person know this person? I'm like, holy crap, that's Cruelty to Divine Curtis. And had a little bit of a laugh with that. I mean, I'm old, so I'm senile, so I should have picked up on that sooner.
Well, welcome to Old People's or Us. So, yeah. I get that a lot.
Well, at least you picked up on it. You had to say something to me, Doug.
I couldn't remember the name of Fred Savage, so it shows you where I'm at.
Now, did you see Once Upon a Deadpool where it had Fred Savage in that room again? Okay.
Yes, and he keeps threatening him to just shut up and listen. Or I'm gonna hurt you. Yeah, that was a very odd retelling of the Deadpool movie.
Yeah,
for no apparent reason, but every particular reason, just very. So you guys kind of randomly fell back together, and of course, Doug, you had moved up from Connecticut in after getting your degree in the mid '90s.
Yep.
And continued writing in the Boston area when you two got together to do this. And you just kind of pitched around a couple of ideas and came up with The Mouthful of Those Who Go Forth into the Empty Places of Gods.
Yeah. When I was really into writing, I was really good at coming up with ideas, but really bad at following through and coming up with endings. So I had a couple ideas gestating, and I thought they were really cool plots. They really, they really worked at the beginning stage. And I'm like, these could go somewhere. I don't have the energy or the mental capacity to go anywhere with them. So I'm like, hey, let me see if I get a co-writer out there. So I threw it out on Facebook. I said I'm looking for a co-writer. I have a bunch of cool ideas that I'm unable to complete, and had a couple bites. And then was hoping Curtis was going to be one of them because I was a fan of his Bad World book. And I shot him over two ideas, and this is the one we picked because it just seemed like it would fit better with both of our aesthetics and both of our styles. And, lo and behold, yeah. we meshed better than we ended up realizing. Because when I read it now, I don't even know what I wrote anymore. And what he wrote.
So before we even talk about the book, let's talk about how difficult it is, number one, to write a novella, because it's neither a short story nor a novel. That's why they call it a novella. So it's, it's got its own set of rules and restrictions, but how to write it as a partnership with somebody else. So Curtis, you started out with a kind of framework and first couple of scenes, and then what happened? I'm sorry, Doug started off with that, happened?
Doug had given that to me. Yeah, so Doug had written, I think, the first two scenes, and he had some idea of like the mythology that he wanted to use a little bit, and I just kind of I started putting together because when I write I'm very much like a plotter, and I have to have very kind of strict architecture to start with. And I'm fine veering off from that, but If I don't plan everything out and write it all down on separate note cards and everything, that I just meander and, you know, I'll just write about nothing for 500 pages. So I have to put an architecture together. So I came up with, you know, a proposed story structure. I sent it to Doug. He tweaked it, sent it back to me, and we kind of sent this outline back and forth together until we came up with an outline that we both liked. And then we just kind of like, oh, well, what chapters do you want to write? Okay, I'll write these chapters. You write these chapters. And then if we got stuck on something, we'd send it to the other one and they'd see if they could, you know, if we could do what the other one couldn't. So it was actually, it ended up being a lot easier than I anticipated it to be. I thought it would be a lot harder to work with somebody on this kind of thing, but Doug and I have a very similar sense of humor. And we have a lot of similar likes in terms of, you know, our influences in horror and such. And even, you know, going back to when we both played in metal bands and stuff, I think that kind of some of the things that are common influences in metal, kind of
the very sensitive nature of being in a metal band. Yeah, I get
that. So, those same kind of influences I think came into play with this. So it wasn't a very stressful thing at all. And as far as the novella length, I think that it just was what it was. Almost everything I write comes out about 50,000 words for some reason. But this obviously didn't. But I don't try to write a novella or a novel or whatever. I just kind of plan it out and then it comes out however long it comes out, you know?
So, how long it would be.
Really? Is that kind of how it works for both of you guys? That the story kind of says, we're done.
Well, when you try to be weird, be funny, and incorporate violence and just wackiness, you don't want to bloat the story too much because you're just gonna not make as much of an impact between scenes if you have things that are going on that aren't necessary but are more filler just to get a word count. I think this novella is really succinct. It's very to the point. It gets its point across, and it moves at a nice clip. And it said, don't overstay your welcome. This scene is done. Go on to something else.
From an honest point of view, and Lord knows, one of the things that drives me nuts about this job that I do here is that there are so many times when a writer will say, oh, I really want to be on the show. Can you send me a copy of your book? And then, you know, the time for the show gets closer and closer. I don't have a book. I don't have a PDF. I don't have anything. And I'm just going to go, no, we can't do this until I read what you're writing, because up until that point, I have no real idea what's going on. So when I got this novella is so hard to pigeonhole. Is it horror? Yes. Is it comedy? Yes. Is it science fiction? I think so. Is it family drama? Is it supernatural? Absolutely. So it's working at all these different levels through the whole thing. And I'm going through, because one of the things that I do, because I'm really, you know, my brain is just not what it used to be anymore. So I'll sit and I'll take notes as I'm reading it. So where am I going to start with this? I'm going to start with the quote that I pulled out of it. Is my body nothing more than a decade-old McDonald's hamburger found in a jacket pocket? And that son of a bitch has been bothering me all week. Because number one, who puts a McDonald's hamburger in a jacket pocket, number one? Number two, decade-old? And number three, it is the perfect description of that moment in a way that I would never have gotten.
I forgot all about that line.
It's a great fucking line. I sat there.
I feel just, like, and I'm not saying this as facetiously as it sounds, it may just be the J. Alfred Prufrock of our time.
You could very well be dead on with that, Zumber, and dead on. And I mean, to start with, I mean, my next note was, and these are totally out of order from the book itself. Who or what is a Brewster Gilligan? And then I realized a Brewster Gilligan was that son of a bitch who's been on Jeopardy for the past month and a half, screwing everybody else out of all their money and then losing it on a stupid technicality.
Yep. You know, Doug came up with the, like I said, the whole game show spiel at the beginning, and you know, he created the character of Brewster and such. But I used to be involved in Mensa. For those who don't know what it is, it's like a high IQ society. And one of the things they have in Mensa are these special, what do they call them? Like special interest groups. They call them SIGs. And, you know, they'll have one for, you know, if you're interested in Bitcoin, or one if you're, you know, interested in anything. They have like a BDSM one. They have everything. But one of them was an underachievers SIG. So it was for, you know, people with really high IQs who just, you know, worked at 7-Eleven, like, and they were 40 and living in their mother's basement. Like, you know, and I was, that always kind of stuck with me because I could kind of relate to that. So when I started writing for Brewster too, I really tried to put in that, kind of the experience that I saw from that with, you know, these really intelligent people who are underachievers, and they were kind of bitter about that. And they felt like the world owed them something because they were good at Jeopardy, you know?
And God damn you both for forcing me to go to the thesaurus on at least 10 different occasions.
And the world and does owe those people their Jeopardy money.
Just, yeah, you know. Absolutely. Absolutely.
To I make mean, a very unimportant point.
I thought for the longest time, and I think it was you, Doug, who was simply making shit up. And then I said, the Obsidian Cromlech must be something. And son of a bitch, it was. And I hated you at that point. Because it then meant that I had to go back to everything else that I thought you made up and see if that was real. And it was all real. Yeah.
Cromlech, that's a deep cut for Monolith.
That is a deep cut indeed. And I'm thinking to myself, why is Obsidian Stonehenge have anything to do with this? And it did. Along with Wink Martindale and every bad game show that ever existed, Boots Randolph, and an impure obsession with the Princess Bride, because everyone seems to be mostly dead.
That's one of my favorite parts. That came out of left field. I'm just reading like the dailies that Curtis would write. Because we use Google Docs, so whenever he was writing, I would just hop on and see what he was writing. And that whole line up in the car with, I don't want to ruin it, but I lost it.
Oh my God, yeah.
Beautiful.
Now, but you see, that's the other problem that we're all having now, is that the book hasn't come out yet, number one. And number two, I want to say enough to let the listeners know that this is so well worth reading without giving away anything. And I'm having a very difficult time with that.
We'll have to give away something, I guess.
Because
Doug and I actually read, we did a live reading of that scene the other night. I think we talked about the weird horror readings I do in Salem.
Yes.
We did one this past Thursday, and Doug and I did a tandem reading of that scene.
Uh-huh. And how did it go?
Experience. It was a fly by the seat of your pants kind of shoot from the hip kind of thing, but we got our point across.
People, you got a few laughs.
They picked up what we were putting down.
That's the important thing is that and I tend to be a fairly critical reader, and there wasn't a point in time with at which I went, Boots Randolph, seriously? We're going there now? And yet we did. And you riffed out on British comedy for a paragraph or so, and within the next four or five paragraphs had done this horrible joke about Ghostbusters, and on and on and on. And at the same time that you're kind of, you know, sticking pointy sticks through the bars at us just to annoy us, you're actually weaving this marvelous story about a guy who gets told something by his grandfather, and when he gets lost and trying to answer a question on a game show, thinks he knows the answer because of something his grandfather once said, and it's dead wrong.
Yep.
And that's how the book starts, with the Order of the Nine Lunar Mansions.
And the Order of the Nine Lunar Mansions, it's Doug could probably explain it a little bit better, but he got the inspiration for that whole idea from this band Mississippi Bones, and we're both friends with this guy Jared from that band, who actually wrote the introduction for the novella. But Doug, you know, he got that whole inspiration for the Nine Lunar Mansions from them. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that, Doug.
Please, yeah, do.
Yeah. Jared has a song on one of his albums, The Butcher of the Night of the Lunar Mansions, and it's based on a fictional true story, kind of, about a goldfish that can make people's brains explode. And the owner of the goldfish is the goldfish scribe. He takes photographs and writes memoirs and notes of the goldfish's exploits. And this goldfish is the butcher. And it's just an expansion on that mythology, where we bring in just the lunar mansions and the cult. And then we try to bring a little bit of a, you know, reality with the religions in to kind of ground it. No goldfishes though.
Hello.
No, I haven't heard of goldfish yet. And
yeah. All right. I'll be right there. Thank you.
You're welcome.
But, it's interesting I should send you the introduction at some point, because Jared just sounds like a crazy person, but it's he does. He sounds like he's out. It sounds like, you know, just a letter from somebody in an asylum, but it makes sense by the end of it. It's very cool. In his whole idea on this butcher of the lunar mansions, who I guess, you know, in a sense would, in our story, would be, you know, like Cameron or whatnot.
Right. Good old Grandpa Cameron.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it
who's butcher, mostly dead?
The butcher's really like the essence of nothing, and like wants nothing to, like wants to get rid of any existence, kind of. That's kind of where Jared came out of. But I guess this whole butcher concept, Jonathan Rabb from Muzzleland Press, he's kind of incorporated it into some of his work. And so it's kind of expanding out into the zeitgeist a little bit on a microcosmic level.
Jared is a very clever guy. He's very stream of conscious, but with a plot.
That's always helpful.
Yeah.
If there's actually a reason for it, it's always a good thing.
He gets there eventually. But he has fun along the way. And he's one of my favorite vocalists, one of my favorite lyricists, and he's a good guy. And I thank him every time I can to put in this silly earworm in my head to get this story on paper.
Well, I mean, that's kind of an interesting overarch to what this novella is. It's interesting and amazing, and eventually it gets you where you're going to go. Mostly dead my ass. Fucking riddance. It's just another quote that I pulled out of the story, and I just kind of went, yeah, dead on. Thank you very much. So you guys have taken this and done a great job of making it impossible for me to figure out where one writer jumps into another writer. There's a flow to this that works very, very well. Did that come naturally, or what did you have to, like, you know, take a little bit of light grain sandpaper and smooth out the edges?
I feel like it came pretty naturally. What do you think, Doug?
For me, that was the easiest part.
It was
almost seamless. It was harder to come up with plot points and incorporate the different religions than it was to mesh our story together. Like I said, when I read it now, I could honestly, there's scenes that I honestly couldn't tell you if I wrote or not, because we both put our mark on pretty much every sentence, because we went back and forth. How's this edit? What about this line edit? I like that, but let's do that. So we both had our own sections, but then we both went over it and put our seal of approval on everything, and ended up agreeing most of the time.
And I think
I was going to say, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just gonna say, we have enough of a familiarity with each other's work too. I started writing kind of a guest blog about collaboration because of this, and I had reached out to a couple other people I know who have done collaborations, just being like, you know, what am I missing here? Like, what points? And I was talking to Jeffrey Thomas, the guy, he's done like the Punktown books and such. And he collaborated with the late Willem Pugmire, and he made the point of, you know, if you're really familiar with each other's work and really respect each other's work, it's so much easier to have your voices mesh. And I think that was really true with Doug and I. We both read each other's work and both liked what we were doing. So it made things very easy to kind of mesh. And I was worried about that more than anything, I think, because I feel like I can be a poor judge of my own work. But
what do you mean by that?
I think that sometimes I like the stuff that I write that no one else likes. And then there's stuff I write and I'm like, this is garbage. And everybody's like, this is the best thing you've ever done.
Well, why is that a bad thing? I mean, you're saying it like it's a bad thing.
Oh, I'm not. I'm just saying, like, you know, I was concerned about, it seemed like it meshed to me, but I was still concerned that it didn't, because I'm a poor judge of my own work. You know?
So, I mean, but what I'm getting out of this is there's a mutual level of respect that started with friendship more than anything else.
Yeah,
so that as you're working together, because, you know, frankly, I've talked to a bunch of people who've collaborated on novels, and some of them work very, very well. Others of them pretend to have worked very, very well. And then once the microphone clicked off, it was like tap dancing in bare feet in an ice house. But obviously, Doug, this is the first time we've met. This is the first work of yours that I've read, but I've read a bunch of Curtis's stuff. And for me, it was, yeah, he could have written every one of these jokes, but I knew he didn't. And he could have written every one of these, you know, pulpy dioramas of gore, as you put it at one point, but I knew he didn't. So there seems to have been a really, really, really great fit with the two of you this time around.
Yeah.
And no, obviously there wasn't a question there. Sorry, it was a fucking statement. That's what I do.
Well, this is as good a time as any to say, sorry I ruined the recording because my dinner came.
No, it's okay. I figured that's why you heard the clacking to the door. Because
you didn't hear any music, did you?
No, that's no okay. Music.
Oh, good, because I definitely don't sing 90s hip-hop staples while putting together plates of food.
Oh, okay. What 90s
that's not me. I never do that.
What 90s hip-hop staple did you not sing?
I cannot tell you that, Dome. Number one, because
well, at least
I know the title, And number two, because I'm never sure if I'm singing one song or three that I've somehow smashed together.
It happens to the best of us. Well, it happens to me. I don't know if I'm the best of anything at this point.
It's just a medley.
Yeah, we'll call it a medley. And I think that would work just fine. So the question I have for you two guys is, and we'll start with the statement before the question, because it seems like that's what I do lately. Because this worked so well and is such a cohesively cool piece of work that is not mostly dead, are you planning on A, continuing in this universe, or B, collaborating on something else?
Yeah, well, Doug's already sent me notes for some ideas for continuing on this.
And, yeah, I've had ideas where to go with the story for now. My OCD makes me have to work in trilogies.
Has to be three, for Christ's sake. That's all. Got to be three.
So, I mean, I sent what I had, my ideas, over to Curtis for him to go over. But, you know, we don't want to, you know, jump the gun or anything. We want to make sure that people are actually digging the first one before we rush out and do a sequel. But, I mean, I got nothing on my plate. So if it does good, then I'm down for staying in this world and writing a little bit more.
Yeah, and absolutely. I'm definitely interested in pursuing it further. But, you know, as Doug said, we want to just kind of gauge the response first and make sure that we're not just we're not the only guys buying a copy.
When you have a novella that intrinsically tells a very interesting story while dancing you around with Benny Hill, Harold Ramis, Boots Randolph, and Wink Martindale, you're off to a good start, guys.
Thank you.
I really, really enjoyed this novella. Curtis, you know that I love your work. I'm a big fan. Doug, I'm really digging this, and it's a lot of fun. And guys, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Sci-Fi Saturday Night tonight.
Appreciate you having us.
And the book is up for pre-order on ebook. So if anybody wants to go to Amazon, you can get the pre-order now. They're supposed to be putting out a limited edition hardcover. I don't have any details on that really yet, but if you check out Gehenna and Hinnom, that's the publisher, if you keep an eye on them on Facebook or on their website, details on the paperback and the hardcover should be up.
And we will have all the links for you attached to the podcast tonight.
Awesome.
So there will be no problem there. Doug, Curtis, guys, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Sci-Fi Saturday Night is the official podcast of Granite Con, Keene Comic Con, Plastic City Comic Con, BooksandBooze.com, and ComicArthouse.com. Visit ComicArthouse.com for some of the best deals on original art from dozens of your favorite artists. And anytime you want to bring in the music, let me know, because you can do that. There you go. If you're looking for something really, really good as a gift for St. Swithin's Day celebration, consider looking at Sci-Fi Saturday Night's first anthology, My Peculiar Family, now on Amazon and at BarnesandNoble.com. My Peculiar Family, the audiobook, is also available on Audible, because that's where you find audiobooks these days. Our intro production was provided by Rob Watts. For more of his amazing stuff, just look at robwattsonline.com. Check out Watts Sauce. It's hot. Our outro music that you're listening to now was provided by Lawrence Made Me Cry. Their grooves can be found on lawrencemademecry.com. A big hello to JoJo and Celine. We miss you, ladies. Many thanks to the gang from the Peabody Time Tunnel, the sweetheart of the soundboard, Kriana, and woman of words and dinner, Zombrarian. Thank you so much, ladies. This is Dome saying, Terry and Jeannie, shared pain is lessened, shared joy increased. Thus do we all refute entropy. We'll talk soon, Stacy. Enjoy the chaos, everyone.
Hello? Yeah, I'll be right there.
I know.